Starting from a 90-year-old family recipe, Wickles are wickedly delicious pickles packed with garlic and peppers, a staple in our skiff and all shoreline lunches. Originating from Sim's grandmother's kitchen to a pantry near yours, from pickles, okra, relishes, and spreads, check them out to elevate all of your meals to the next level. Duck Camp makes outdoor goods so you can outdoor good. From the shallow water flats to the mallard-filled marshes, Duck Camp is there to make you feel comfortable and enhance the quality of your time in the elements. Not only do they make some of the best outdoor apparel on the market, but they support many of the organizations near and dear, fighting for our resource in the natural world. Check them out at duckcamp.com and tell them we sent you.
We broke everything. We broke lines. We broke hooks. We broke rods. We broke our minds. We broke marriages. We broke the whole thing.
We came up with the idea of going out that night and chasing girls, and whoever had the biggest pair of panties won the pot.
I knocked another arrow, and he turned around the other way, and I shot him going through the other way. So I double-lunged him both ways.
But it was nothing for us to paddle an air mattress out into Government Cut.
I got him on. All right, now we're going to teach him a lesson.
I'm just an old guy that likes to fish. I'm not quitting yet.
And he said, well, who the hell do you think you are, Sue App? And I said, that's exactly who I am.
Life's journey to the grave should not be one arriving with a pretty, well-preserved body, but rather skid in broadside in a cloud of smoke, thoroughly torn out, thoroughly used up, proclaiming wildly, wow, what a ride.
There's something fishy going on here.
Thank you.
Beautiful. You got to get all of us. If Rachel's going in, you got to go.
Should we do this on camera?
It's already rolling.
Well, hell yeah.
Good morning, New Jersey.
Like Buffett says, it's 5 o'clock somewhere.
All right, that's good. That's good. That's good. That's good.
Well, what the hell? I'm 71 going on 75 with this shot right now.
Oh, man.
Corrected coffee.
Here we go.
Here we go, man. Cheers,
yeah,
Rachel.
Man.
Thank you so much
for coming on.
Yeah, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on.
Good enough.
I'll hurt my back if I go any further.
How'd you hurt your back? Well, I was
drinking coffee. I could get hurt.
That's always how it happens, man. Especially like you're an athlete, right? So you have an injury and somebody's like, how'd you do that, man? Were you like, you know, skiing off a cliff or something? You're like, no, I rolled over in bed.
I tripped walking in my truck.
Yeah, I sneezed.
He tripped over a paver walking, tore his rotator cuff, was out for like 6 months.
No.
At the Palm Beach Boat Show, I'm walking in my truck after the presentation. My boot caught the edge of a raised paver.
Yeah.
I did this face plant with a heavy bag on my shoulder. I tore my rotator cuff and pulled my bicep tendon off my shoulder.
Of your fishing arm? Well, you probably are both, but your dominant arm?
It's my everything arm.
Oh, fuck. And did you have any shoulder issues before that?
Yeah, but not like that.
But not like that. That was probably the only joint in your body that you probably hadn't.
It had already hurt, but of the 24 operations I've had, that was probably the worst.
Really?
To do this?
Yeah.
It's like forever you're going.
How long did it take to get back?
A year.
Ooh.
It completely, my golf swing was already on the downside,
yep.
But with that destroyed my, I had 100 and some mile an hour swing before that, and I went right down to like 78, you know.
Oh, man.
All right, this podcast is about Rachel, not you getting hurt
anymore. No, it's all good.
So.
Enough about me. What do you think about me?
But remember, what's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine.
That's right, man.
Rachel, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast.
My pleasure.
I saw the film. I looked up a bunch of stuff about you, about your fishing career, your guiding, where you've been. You've got such a rich life, no question, in fishing. But I think your life as a person far exceeds your life as a fisherman. You know, and one of the things I was thinking about this recently, we were talking about somebody said, who are you? How do you answer that question? Because a lot of times you think, well, I'm a fisherman. I've done this. I've done that. These are things we do.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think a little bit deeper, who are you? It doesn't include the things we do.
Right.
Who are you?
Well, I think first and foremost, I'm an artist. That's really, as much as I try to not be an artist, so because I'm lazy, but I think that my inherent being is as a creative person. And I don't have the typical fishing background that most of you guys have, like my family, my dad taught me to fish. I don't come from that kind of a background. But as far back as I can remember, I was always drawing or, you know, looking at life in that kind of a creative French word, whatever, way. So I would say that's my, like, down to the core description of me would be, and that meaning like an artist, like I'm always making art, but I'm an observer.
You're also, you're not conventional in any way.
No.
I was going to say, starting
out. Well, even from the way I look and my name.
And your laugh. What a beautiful laugh.
Oh, thank you.
When I called you the other day, I said, Rachel.
You fucked me up, man. You're like, when do you remember the first time you laughed? And I'm like, dude, that's deep. Like, no, I don't. Like, I've been thinking about it since then. I'm like, yeah.
But your laugh is very different. It's very boisterous. It's full of life.
Well,
it's got big power.
Thank you. I don't know if that's a good thing or bad. Sometimes it's not so good. But
what do you mean it's not so good?
No, I mean, you know, I am what I am, right? I mean, I'm loud. Well, so I am loud and boisterous, but I'm actually very much the opposite, too, in a lot of ways.
Are you kind of shy?
As a kid, I was painfully shy. Which is surprising, right? Now to most people that meet me, I was like the kind of kid that like hung on my dad's leg, you know, and was really shy. And I don't know when I started to become more gregarious or whatever, but I am pretty shy and quite sensitive, actually.
when you were growing up, were your friends creative in art in that way?
Or not so much. I was I grew up in suburban Boston, okay, Newton, Massachusetts, and I was a tomboy. I was an athlete, you know, and I know it's hard to believe now, but—
What was your sport?
Played everything. But remember this, I'm 61 years old, so being a girl back then, it wasn't a lot of, you know, women's sports opportunities. So whatever, I played with the boys. Most of my friends were boys. And I was pretty good, man. I was like, you know, so we played whatever. We played baseball. We played street hockey, you know, big Boston thing.
Wow.
And then my family, my dad is a shoe designer, women's shoes. So when I was 10 years old, he moved our family to Florence, Italy to work there.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was cool. Amazing. Life changing. And I started playing soccer. You know, and I went to this amazing little American school there that was full of expats and people. And I started playing soccer and it was only a boys team. So I played on the boys team. I was actually captain of the boys team.
That's amazing.
That's so
cool. So from
cool.
the beginning, I was always accepted by guys as for my ability. And I think that has been a benefit to me. I mean, it's just whatever. Some women aren't, it's not like I don't know. It's just made things a lot easier.
There's no barriers.
No barriers. Yeah. And nobody ever put barriers on me. So I think that was a really, and team sports, right? I mean, I was a real team sports person. Mm-hmm. So that shaped my character. But yeah, I didn't have a lot of creative friends and I had a very conventional, you know, childhood like that, going to high school, playing all varsity level sports every season. I'm sort of ambidextrous in a weird way. So I throw right, I fish right, All right, throw left, fish right, tennis right, soccer left. I always wanted to play shortstop in softball, and they wouldn't let me. So I was like, fuck that, man. So I started playing lacrosse, and that was a great sport. And then I went to college. I did want to go study art in college. So to find, like, I didn't want to go to art school, though, because I wanted to play sports. You know, no art schools have sports teams, like varsity-level sports teams. So I ended up going to a small liberal arts college in New York State called Skidmore College, and was able to pursue an art degree and play, you know, sports. So I played soccer, ice hockey. They had ice hockey, which was amazing.
Very cool.
Because there was no ice hockey for girls back then. And they're like, hey, we're going to have an ice hockey team. Do you want to play? I'm like, fuck yeah, I want to play. I'm like, do you know how to skate? I'm like, not really, but I'll play goalie. I was a soccer goalie. How hard can it be, right? You know, so it was amazing. You know, we were just this great group of women. There were actually a few women that had gone to like private schools where they did have hockey programs, but most of us were just like curious or had brothers that always played. I did not. I have a brother, but he wasn't a hockey player. So that was like a dream come true to be able to play hockey. And I was pretty good, actually. But yeah, so and then a lacrosse, I played, you know, 4 years. I played varsity level sports and then was doing art. And then wanted to pursue art. So this was in Saratoga Springs, New York. I took a couple years off after college and stayed in that town. That's where I met my husband, Jeff. He owned a bar in Saratoga. And so I hung out there, and then I decided I want to continue with art. So I applied to graduate schools, and I got into Yale, which was like, who would have thought that would have happened? And went to get a master's of fine arts in Yale, and was never fishing, wasn't even fishing back then. I was actually windsurfing when I got out of college, right? So you had all that organized sports stuff going on and all team stuff. So when I got out of school, I'm like, now what do I do, man?
Was like, you lost your playground.
Yeah. I lost all my playmates, you know?
Was your dream coming out of college to be an independent artist and sell your art for dealers or collectors or museums?
I'm not quite sure what I thought. For a little while, in the beginning of college, I thought, okay, I'll pursue like commercial art, graphic art. And then I took a painting class, and I'm like, oh, this is great. I really want to do this. But I was also very interested in theater. I'm a huge... Like most guys, I'm a huge musical theater freak, you know? I mean, kidding, but...
I was just going to question that.
Like, no.
I know.
It's like, yeah, like, okay, so I also toyed with the idea. I worked, had a job in Albany as a scenic artist. I thought, okay, I'll go be a scenic artist. But then I really liked just painting. So I guess, yeah, when you start... you know, studying painting, and especially in a program like Yale, you the drive is, yes, you're going to go to New York City, you're going to slay it, you're going to be a fucking famous artist, which is, like, brutal, right? Mm-hmm. So I did follow that model.
And you lived in Brooklyn, right?
I did for a while. When I got out of Yale, Jeff was not a city guy. He had just sold his bar, and we made kind of a deal like to move outside of the city, you know, to see, have him pursue whatever he was into, was bartending or whatever. And I would go be able to go into the city, and that didn't work. We actually broke up. We weren't married, but he went north. His dream, he grew up around the Saratoga area. He was a skier from the beginning. And his idea, dream was to move up to Lake Placid and become a ski patroller and live up there. So he went up there, and I did go to the city. And I lived all around. I never lived in Manhattan. Started off in Jersey City. Then a group of my friends from Yale, we had a tight group of friends. We got the lease of a floor of a building in Brooklyn, a 10,000-square-foot loft building.
Wow.
And it was in Greenpoint. And back then, Greenpoint, which is a neighborhood right on the river, okay, so closer to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Polish neighborhood, but, right. You know, it was full of, like, crackheads and everything. It was an industrial building, and the six of us renovated this entire floor all by ourselves and made living spaces out of it, which was all illegal, but it was amazing. It was fucking amazing. And I had a loft that was bigger than this room. It was 1,500 square feet.
Wow.
Had 15-foot ceilings, And we put all our own plumbing in, man. I was the solderer. I was really good at sweating pipe back then. This was copper, no PEX and everything. But and had these amazing living spaces. And we back then I didn't have any skills, like marketable skills. But I ended up I worked as an assistant to my mentor, a painter. His name was Jake Berteau. He was an amazing guy, and I was kind of his assistant. So I would stretch his canvas. You know, this is like the artist's typical, really like a dream to work for your hero. It would be like, I work for Stu Apt. I do all his rigging. Right. I clean his reels, and you'd be like jazzed about cleaning his reel. You'd be like, oh, wow, So I did that for a while. And then I would visit Jeff up north, And then finally I said, okay, I'm going to try living up there. And once I started living up there, I was like, dude, this is pretty nice.
Is that when you discovered fishing? Fly fishing? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So during this whole time, and before that, after college, I got into windsurfing big time. So I'm obsessive, right? So whatever I get into, I get into. And it was funny because Jeff and his buddies, this was a party town, man. Saratoga was like bars closed at 4 a.m. Sometimes he'd get home at like 7 a.m. Oh, and then they'd go hang out at this lake. And they had like a Windsurfer One design, which was like one of the first windsurfers. And these guys invented stand-up paddleboarding, okay? This is almost 40 years ago. They would just lay around on the board. They didn't put the sail on. They were paddle around, drinking, whatever, smoking pot, dogs, And I'm like, what's that thing? And they're like, oh, there's this sail that goes on it. We don't do that part. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to check that out. So I started doing that, and that was like, So I would do that wherever I could. And flash forward up. 10 years, and I would go down to North Carolina, probably drive right past Sarah and those guys, on the Cape Hatteras or lakes or wherever. Right. I did it in New Haven, wherever you can do it, you do that sport. And that's a terrible sport to be into because once you get into it, ooh, is that a dog? Once you get into it and you want a lot of wind, you can't like predict when there's going to be a lot of wind.
Yeah.
So I was like just compulsive liar. It's just I have Tuesday off. I'm going to go windsurfing, but it's windy on Monday. You're like, fuck, I can't come in today or whatever job. I was bartending. I had all kinds of stuff. And then eventually I was up north in the Adirondacks visiting Jeff, and I was windsurfing on this small lake by myself, and I injured my back really bad. I was by myself. I was wearing a dry suit, the old O'Neill dry suit with a big neoprene suit with a zipper on the back, right? And I'm like lying on the ground there. Going, fuck, what am I going to do? I attached the zipper pull to the car and kind of got myself out, got myself home, and I was pretty messed up.
How did you obviously fell with, windsurfing?
I don't know what happened, man. I think a back injury like that is, I think progressive years of bad posture.
So it wasn't a bad fall on the windsurfer?
No, it was just like we were just talking about before we started, like, right. How'd you do it? I don't know, I like twisted and whatever. I was fucked up, but... And I had injured my back before that, but it was pretty bad. And so it was a long rehab. And Jeff had grown up fly fishing.
Mm-hmm. Was he fishing at the time?
We were fishing together at the time, like when we got together, but all spin fishing. We'd go out and classic Adirondack style, like troll Lake Clear wobblers and worms for brook trout and stuff in the lakes or ponds, as we call them. And I'm like, all right. This is, he was always rowing the boat or doing in control of it. And I was like, just sort of, okay, whatever.
You weren't intrigued with it.
I wasn't like that intrigued with it, especially because I didn't understand what was going on underneath the water.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was messed up with the back injury, he's like, well, why don't you go fly fishing? Yeah, I'm living literally a mile and a half from the West Branch of the Au Sable River. So... I'm like, okay. So he gave me a Leonard bamboo rod that belonged to his grandfather. His grandfather had won this rod in a poker game at a fishing lodge in New Hampshire years ago. His grandfather started him fly fishing. He's got the classic. He had the classic story of learning.
Great DNA.
Yeah. And so I was just, that was it, man. The minute I just fucking did that every day. I was out there every day. I had no idea what I was doing. And what really amazes me now living there for so long and having this beautiful river is I went to the same spot every day. I didn't catch a fish for I don't even know how long it was. And then there was this older man that would kind of show up at the same spot. And we would kind of like compete, you know. He was very heavy set dude. And back then, you're not going to know what this is. You might remember what seal dry waders were. Do you remember? They were like latex.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just put these waders on. This guy became my like best friend, right? You know, and taught me so much. He was like my first kind of fly mentor. But we would go fly fishing. And that was it for me. And I loved immediately, even without catching fish, being in the water and all of like the just the visual, you know, so connected to what was going on.
Well, I think I'm just guessing here. You're such an artist. I think the artistry of maybe throwing the fly and the loop and the rhythm and the tempo of casting a fly line.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole pace of fly fishing,
mm-hmm.
you know, the bug life, the rivers flowing,
mm-hmm.
the birds, the fly rod. I was always enamored initially with being able to throw that line.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like a stroke on a canvas.
It's beautiful. Right? Oh, exactly. And there is that guy that makes the have you seen that guy? I forget his name. He paints. It's kind of shticky. He I think I just made up a word.
I love
he paints with his
words.
Fly line?
Well, shtick, you know, that's like, not stick. Shtick. I'm Jewish, so that's like a Yiddish word, but shticky. Anyways, yeah, the dude puts like paint on the end of whatever. I don't know what he's got on the end of the line, whether it's like a little piece of material I don't think it's a brush per se, or maybe he's made. I don't want to screw with this guy. He makes some cool paintings, and he just sort of casts at the canvas and it with paint and kind of
splatters it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, whatever. Gets you off.
You said on the phone, you call yourself an artist, a hoarder, and a guide, right? I want to dive into the hoarding thing here, okay, if you don't mind. Come on, let's go to the dark side.
We've covered the artist.
Man. Yeah.
Oh, she's a hoarder.
I don't know, man.
Do you watch that on TV, The Hoarders?
I have seen it. Yeah, I don't want to see it because I'll have to start therapy watch that.
Are you like tenfold hoarder? Are you just dabble with hoarding?
You can walk into my house, but I don't know, man. I'm just like well, why should I throw that away? You know, or like, you know, I just accumulate objects and things. And I'm always, so Jeff passed away in 2019. And now I live in the house that we both lived in by myself. And I just cannot believe that two people lived in that house. He didn't have as much stuff as I had, but whatever. There's just, and most of it's fishing stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know. And,
have you ever been to Bob Popovich's house?
No, but I bet it's pretty.
Oh my God, it's just insane. we did a podcast with him the other day and upstairs.
Yeah. So, I've seen pictures of it. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's crazy. So they used to have, like, you know, I think he said at one point maybe 100 people in that house. I know 50.
No, not 100.
But
you
50,
can't physically get 100.
I know, but he had 50.
Yeah. Maybe.
Anyway, it's a small little room.
Yeah.
And every Tuesday night from January to May,
yeah,
they would all go there and they would all tie flies individually.
Awesome.
They would share information, talk about fishing. And the staircase going up is about that narrow into this little room. And he said guys would be on the staircase looking up between the legs of other guys in the room to gather and hear the information that was
and
taking
place.
It's
got place. Like,
yeah,
this a, isn't, I remember seeing
A-frame.
Pictures. Yeah. Okay.
It's
yeah. It's like the, attic,
yeah.
right? Or something.
There was no
yeah.
room for a full podcast with three
and
of
he's
us.
A
so
big
it's just,
dude, right?
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah, he's big.
But he's got all the information from the early years of the saltwater fly rodders of America.
Wow.
The ground floor.
It's like
of fly
an archive.
Fishing. Yes. And there's boxes and flies, and you have no idea. But it's all invaluable stuff.
I feel better. I wouldn't say that my stuff is invaluable, but.
It's invaluable to you. Perhaps. Otherwise, you wouldn't.
Maybe.
Be
I don't know. Do you
it.
Really need that many wading belts? You know. I mean.
Oh,
like,
really? That kind of stuff.
Well, like stuff you've accumulated, like or never thrown away.
Yeah.
You know, like I could open a size 9 shoe store. You know,
really?
For wading shoes. You know, I gave them all away. But at one point, I think in my basement, I had, I don't know, like fucking like 25, 30 pairs of wading shoes. Yeah. But all the same size, right? I'm open, like the size 9 school of fly fishing, you know?
Or were they made by Prada with cleats on the bottom?
No, dude, Patagonia, man.
Yeah, tell me about your hat real quickly.
Okay, so this is an Argentine hat called a boina, and it's a gaucho hat.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend some time in Argentina, and I love hats. I'm a hat person. But once I knew the minute I saw this kind of hat that I had to have one. And I love it because it's just, as we were talking about yesterday, it's so expressive. You can kind of, you know, rock it any way you want it.
Well, you gave me one.
Let's see it. Rock it, man. I know you got to do the Hardy thing, but you have the best visor hair, though.
Well, thank God, I'm 71, I even have hair.
There you go.
I mean, look at Popovich. He's 75, and he's looks like a bald egg.
There you go. That's good.
That's good. You're rocking it like a backwards hat, though. You want it out in front of forward?
That's okay. You can rock it
any way you want. I used to wear berets backwards.
Yeah.
Get closer to the mic,
but you can, rock it any way you want. That's the way, you know, however you're feeling. But it's also, I wear it guiding because it actually covers my ears from sun, you know, better than a baseball hat.
Are you into fly tying?
Yes.
Because I feel like that'd be a natural progression for you.
Yes. I'm not a very good fly tier, but I love it. I love doing it. You know what? I love doing it for flies that I'm going to use,
right.
But I'm a guide. So I have to, you know, crank out like, you know, okay, I'm going to tie like 150 girdle bugs. Like, what's fun about that? Nothing to me, at least. Like production tying, you know?
Right, take assembly line.
And guide flies, you know, nothing too serious. But I like to steelhead fish. I like to swing flies. So I love to tie like that. You know, when you're tying for yourself, you'll like tie like one or two, you know, of what you're doing. And then that's fun. You know, when you have to tie like 50, you know, a sable wolf. So you're like, oh, fuck, you know. And then you have to figure out how to, well, what was the, who's the guy that wrote the book on production fly tying? But anyways, so, you know, so spend a whole day like putting beads on hooks, you know,
I don't know
if you guys have ever tied like that. Hopefully you don't have to because it kind of sucks.
I hate tying trout flies.
Really?
Oh my God.
Yeah, tarpon flies are one thing. Yeah. They're so big.
They're so small. It's like, I can't see.
Oh, it's brutal. Yeah.
Like, you know, I got buddies who, you know, the chocolate, you know, they tie these 28, you know.
Oh yeah. That's amazing. Brutal. That's brutal. But
as a guy like Nikki too, you know, you go through so many, you don't want to be buying flies.
Right.
Especially if they're pretty easy to tie.
Right.
I'm kind of interested in how you made the transition from a fly fisherman to a fly fishing guide.
Okay.
Because that's a big step.
It was a big step.
It could be sometimes kind of ugly if you have to make money. And there are a lot of people say, well, I know how to fish. I'm going to become a guide. And then it gets ugly because you're kind of babysitting initially sometimes. Like Nikki says, sometimes these people show up and they don't want to listen to you.
Right.
You're kind of babysitting, you know, all this.
Yeah, I don't call myself a guide. I take people fly fishing.
Okay, well.
Well, if you guide, good, how many days a summer?
You can call yourself a guide. I mean,
honestly, when I think of guides, I think of like, you know, Stu Epp, Steve Huff, Doug Kilpatrick, like the best, like that live and breathe guiding. And I'm just a
year-round guide,
person that takes people fishing.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that diminishes the word guide.
I don't know. Don't be so hard on yourself. I mean, being a guide, well, for me, how it happened was, so I was up in Lake Placid for the summer. I would spend the whole summer up there. Before that, I would commute back and forth from Brooklyn to Lake Placid. And then I was up there for the summer and I needed a job. And here I am with a fancy, you know, degree from Yale. I have absolutely no skills. Like, I don't know how to use a computer. Well, computers were just starting, not just starting, but using computers in business, whatever. I have like nothing like marketable, you know, on paper. So I was driving along the river and there's a place called the Hungry Trout and they had just opened a fly shop. And I saw in the paper, you know, they had an ad for somebody. I'm like, dude, I'm going to go work in a fly shop, you know. So I interviewed with the owner, was Jerry Botcher. And you know, I was good with people. I knew that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, let me work in this shop. And I had no clue about a lot of things, and technical or anything, or flies. And I just learned from there. And actually, how I learned about flies was I was stocking. I had one of those Plano boxes with like 24, you know, little.
Rose.
And I dropped it on the floor of the fly shop. And it was like all fucking caddis, right? And I had to like put them back, you know? And I'm like, what the fuck, dude? Like, I don't even know what these things are, you know? And wow, they're all different sizes, you know? And I was just like, okay, that was like the beginning. And then over time in the shop, we had one guide. And I was like, and he was kind of a rough dude. He was from Western New York, from the Great Lakes Steelhead River, the Salmon River in Western New York. And he was a good angler, but he was kind of rough around the edges, dude, you know? And we had a lot of clients like from the city and, you know, and I would just watch him interact with people. And I'm like, wow, man, I can totally do that way better than him, you know? So the next year I was like, I'm gonna do this. I'm going to get my guide's license. And because it, to me, immediately it seemed, yes, guiding is about fishing, but guiding is about people, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. It's an entertainment yeah. business. It really
well,
is.
Well, it's an entertainment business, but it's really, it's a service, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's, I think the more, you know, I've been doing it over 30 years. So really the one thing that I think, at least, the more that I do it, it's almost like the less it is about the fishing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's more about trying, for me at least, trying to sort of get inside this person's head and figure out what they want without really asking them. Mm-hmm. You know, like, because everybody wants something different, right? You got the guy that, well, here's a great example. I had these two brother-in-laws, right? Frank and Bob. They're actually from New Jersey. And they couldn't have been more opposite, right? And they'd show up and I'd say, Frank, you know, what do you want to do today? And he's like, oh, I just got this two-weight Winston, you know, I wanna just throw a little dry fly and maybe catch a little brook trout, you know? And I'm like, okay, cool. And Bob, what do you want to do today? Well, I want to catch big fish and a lot of them.
That's every one of my clients.
Right. And so, all right, let's just get it. I'm an asshole. So I would say to Bob, I said, Bob, well, Bob, I want world peace. Let's just, you know, somewhere in between these two ideas, we can maybe meet. And Bob would always win out because he was very aggressive. And actually, at one point, I guess Bob was like a competitive bass guy. So he was an animal. And he was also he was a very good angler. He was so fucking lucky, man. Like, because it would get to the point where I would go out of my way and I would put Bob, yeah, Bob, go down there, man. Yeah, just go check that out down there. And I didn't know yeah. if it was any good or whatever. Frank, you come up here with me. And, you know, it was all walk wade. I do all walk wade. So on a pocket water river. So it was brutal. You know, you're back and forth in the rocks. And Bob would always come up with a fucking big fish, man. I mean, he was amazing, you know. Mm. But the idea is to see what somebody wants and what somebody can do physically, because where I live, it's very intimidating. It's very hard waiting. So, you know, there are guides that will like force you to do something. You know, you're not paying me to like scare you. Or maybe you are. Some people like that, you know? That's what I'm saying. Like, really getting inside somebody's head, and if they're open to it, helping them, teaching them. I'm really, I think it's important that a guide teach, you know, and show people how to do things if they're open to it. You were talking about, you know, people not listening to you, and that happens too, mm-hmm. you know? So to me, guiding is... I mean, I'm sort of fishing vicariously through them. And yeah, you do have a lot of times where you're like trying not to look at your watch, but looking at your watch, you mm-hmm. know? Then Sims came out with that jacket that had the clear thing
oh, is that
over
right?
your watch. Yeah, I was like, that's fucking brilliant, dude. Like, because you know, how many times? Okay. and, but that doesn't happen very often. And I enjoyed it. I almost felt like you're a coach, mm-hmm. you know, and that the success is your success or the failure is your failure, you know, and trying to have fun too is important. And also, you know, trying to give somebody the space they're looking for. Or, like I said, everybody wants something different, you know?
Whether on the boat, on the river, or in the woods, Yeti products are by our side. There are many innovative first-class companies in the outdoor market today, but none more so than Yeti. In 2006, they took the industry by storm when they produced their first roto-molded cooler that was reliable and built for the wild. 17 years later, with a multitude of new products, they continue to raise the bar and be the gold standard for all outdoor brands. We couldn't be more proud to have them as a Millhouse sponsor and a family member. Pappas Pilar is a spirit that embodies adventure. Named after the late great Ernest Hemingway and his boat, the Pilar, the name says it all. This ultra-premium blended rum is hand-selected from around the Caribbean and blended by master blender Ron Call. After a long day on the water, when the sun is descending the sky, end on a good note with Pilar by your side. Go support them at PappasPilar.com or a liquor store near you.
I had a guy who's now a very good client of mine, very successful business dude, whatever, and he just needed to, like, unplug. And he would, first time I take him out, he brings this, like, fucking Barca lounger outdoor chair. I'm like, okay, man, whatever. Puts it up, goes out, catches two fish. Then he just goes and just fucking takes a nap, you know? And I'm like, okay, like, what am I doing now? And I'm like, you're doing whatever you want. This guy's doing what he wants. You know, let him have his space, you know, where there are people that just want to fish 24 hours a day. You know, some people like to chill. I mean, I think that's the real art of guiding, is to really, like, get what that person is after without really having to – you can ask them what they want. And I do always ask people what they're up for doing. Do you want to fish? Do you want to check this out? Do you know, what kind of water do you want to fish? We have very – variable water where I live, and
I think a lot of times people don't even really know what they want.
Right. Well, then you know, then you kind
of
have,
unless you have somebody who's a really a good angler, and right? They've done a lot of fishing.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Most of the time, I got a lot of beginners. Where I live, the fishing is hard, man. It's not an easy place to
fish.
Do
you fall in often?
You know, I'm pretty okay. So I was. Pretty good athlete, pretty good balance, and I probably went 25, 26 years falling in literally maybe 4 or 5 times. Pretty good, right? And then I got cancer in 2017, and I had a chemo. I had a very rare abdominal cancer. And we did had to do some very strong chemo. And after that, I got peripheral neuropathy, mm-hmm. which is nerve damage. And that was a real eye-opener for me. The first time I went fishing after the treatment stopped, I fell 3 consecutive days face plant. Not like, you know, you would think. I just had no balance, no sense of, so I literally just went face first into the water 3 days in a row, and I almost quit fishing. I was really upset and mad, but I just learned how to adapt. I had to, like, start over, essentially.
Waiting with canes or with a stick?
Staff, yeah. And I was waiting with a staff. A lot of people use staffs where I am, actually, but I was using a staff before that, but I really had to, like, start wearing a shoe size bigger, whatever. But, you know,
adapt.
I got it.
Does that sound familiar, Ted?
I fall in the water every day I go fishing.
Well, that's okay.
I suck. I used to be able to dance on those moss-covered
rocks. Dude, as a skier,
rocks.
Man? Come on.
Oh, no, I'm terrible. I fall in with water this deep. I'm standing there all of a sudden, boom.
I'll see him cross the river, and I'll just sit back and get my phone out and start filming because I know what's happening.
And then he posts it. He makes me look like an idiot.
Me.
Andy doing something. I go fishing with wet diapers.
Oh,
like
I,
almost.
I am a real, if I get wet, there's no bigger baby than me. I'm like, I'm going home. You know, I'm just a real baby. So, but the Aux Sable is is renowned tough wading. We call them the grease bowling balls. They're big rocks, slippery, nasty. It's not really the current that's going to get you. It's just the slickness. So years ago, we used to have that ESPN Great Outdoor Game thing in Lake Placid, and they did a fishing thing. And there was a – you probably know – do you know Steve Perino?
Yeah, sure.
Skier, ex-skier, commentator. Yeah. And he was doing the fishing commentating. And I met him because we were helping them with locations and things. And I said, hey, you want to go fishing? He's like, yeah. So I said, okay, well, we're going to go, you know, to this really amazing area that I had access to, serious pocket water. And so we're getting out of the car, and I use those full staffs, right, that fold up really small right here. Mm-hmm. I said, here, yeah, I have a bunch of them. I'm like, you want this? He's like, no, I'm good. And I'm like, okay, let's see, you know, because I'm, like I said, I'm an asshole, right? So I'm like, I'm going to kill this guy, right? So, I mean, I didn't try and hurt him, but I said, all right, well, you know, why don't you start here and I'll go behind you and whatever. And that dude, man, I mean, he was a lot younger. We were all a lot younger, but that guy waited like, you know, like you, I see the skiers training online. You see them standing on top of the gym ball.
Yeah,
you
sure. Know?
He was like that. And I'm like, holy shit, dude. He had some skills. But yeah, I'm not as fast as I used to be, but I'm still pretty solid. But the balance thing, the same thing with skiing. I had to like, first time I got on skis after that neuropathy thing started, I was like, felt like I had never been on skis before. Mm-hmm. And I'm a telemark skier. So, and I used to teach skiing to kids. So I had to like basically teach myself to ski again, you know?
How pissed off were you?
I was really pissed off. But, which I think actually made me continue
to push harder.
So
let's go back to the C word, you know, the whole cancer thing. What did you first think when the words came out of that doctor's mouth that you're sick?
You know, I was kind of I had no symptoms. Okay, it wasn't like I wasn't feeling well, you know, or had pain anywhere. It happened to be that I went to my general practitioner doctor, who was a very good friend of mine. And also an angler, avid angler, and for a flu shot. And I got my flu shot, and he just gave me a regular exam, palpate, you know, and he touched my abdomen. He's like, I don't know, man. We've got to get that checked out. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, we'll get an ultrasound. So I had the ultrasound, and you know it's bad when you go for an ultrasound, and the dude is like, I'll be right back, you know, and then he brings another guy into the room and they look at it and they're like, yeah, we'll be right back, you know, and then they bring another guy, you know, and they're like, why don't we want you to go over to the hospital right now to like get a CAT scan? I'm like, oh,
was it a lump that they found?
No, it was it turned out to be it wasn't a tumor. It's not a tumor. It was a, like a big cyst, like fucking big, like this big.
And they could feel it when they were doing the checkup.
Yes, and
you felt nothing before then. You didn't feel like anything was tight
down
there.
Well, I'll tell you what. All right, I'll just tell you exactly.
You're pregnant at any
point? No, I was like fucking 54 years old, dude. So I was doing like some crunches and stuff on a gym ball. And I'll tell you exactly. So I would like sort of pee a little bit, you know, and I'm like, right, this is what happens to old women, right? This is what's happening to me now. Like, not a lot, but just a little would squirt out because of the pressure. sorry. But so I was like, whatever. I didn't think anything of it, you know. But meanwhile, this fucking football inside my – well, actually, what happened was I had this growth inside of my peritoneal cavity, okay? What is that? That's like the space where all your organs are. So this thing grew – inside of there, they don't even know how long. It probably could have even started when I was born or whatever. And I was in New York State, so I went over to Vermont, which was sort of the best medical care, which isn't far. Burlington's like 2 hours. Saw a guy, and he's like, yeah, man, we think you have kidney cancer. I'm like, okay. And nothing really, like, it wasn't like this, I don't know. I was like, okay, now what? He's like, well, we got to do an MRI, and we have an appointment in like 3 weeks. And I'm like, wait a minute. You just told me I have cancer. Now you want me to wait 3 weeks? That doesn't sound right to me. So I called my dad in Boston, and yeah, he's like, no, 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 that's not good. And we had a good friend, family friend, who was a doctor at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, which is Harvard Medical School. And I sent him all my films and everything. He's like, get your ass home. And it ended up that I got a cancer called primary retroperitoneal mucinous cystadenocarcinoma. And very rare. Like, I started looking it up. There are like less than 100 cases of it ever, you know? So, of course, I get that. And so anyways, they had to remove this thing. And I got a big ass scar like here. And when they were taking it out of my body, it broke open.
Oh, no.
And inside of it was like a mucus, okay, liquid. Like, that's what the cancer was being carried in. And it went back into my body. Oh, it's called spillage, yeah. So when...
It's like the balloon popped and all the liquid.
Yeah, and all the shit went back into my body. So after that, they're like, okay, man, we don't really know what to do. I mean, because there wasn't like anything to target, you know, they couldn't like radiate anything. Mm-hmm. So they decided on a very strong chemo. But again, I did not have any serious pain. I mean, chemo sucks, right? I did not lose my hair, but it wasn't pleasant. And I ended up doing all of my treatment in Boston. I just felt like that was the place to be because of the rareness of my cancer. And so I was flying back and forth between my home and Boston and staying with my family in Boston while I was being treated, go home for 2 weeks and then go back for another chemo. And at the end of it, they're like, you're good, man. And for a while, and then like anybody after your treatment, you go every 3 months for a scan or whatever, and then every 6 months. And I did 2 years of that, and then they kind of signed me off, you know?
Did that change you in any way? I know in the movie, you know, that they did about you, you know, documenting, you know, your life and your relationship with Jeff.
Yeah.
You know, is it possible that you changed more radically, dramatically after the passing of Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely.
Than after your cancer?
Oh, for sure. Because I think in the movie I say, and it's true, like, after what happened to him, he got cancer like a year later or 2 years later. I can't remember. But, and, you know, all of the bad things about cancer, hopefully you guys have not had family members or friends that have gone through it. All of the horrible things that can happen to people and the pain and the suffering happened to him.
Oh, God. My brother, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. My brother died last year
at
63.
Oh, dude.
And the cancer took him one cell at a time for 3 years. When he died, he looked to be 120 years old.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So that was Jeff's...
It was fast. It was like 5 months. And Jeff...
Well, at least it was only 5 months.
Yeah, Jeff. But I think, you know, he was a tough dude, very, you know, I don't know if stereotype dude, but I think that I know that he did not feel well for a very long time. You know, and he
even
just,
before it was diagnosed.
Oh yeah,
well, he was hiding it.
He was hiding it, and he was not
trying to tough it out.
Trying to tough it out, or denial, or
what
whatever.
What kind of cancer did he have?
He had a neuroendocrine carcinoma, and Jeff was a great angler, and like I said, he started fishing when he was very young, and then when I started getting just to backtrack. When I started guiding, he was bartending at the Hungry Trout, had a restaurant. And I'm like, dude, you've got to start guiding. You're so good. And I got him into guiding.
Cool.
Yeah. So he stopped being in the bar and he was a ski patroller at Whiteface.
I can relate to all that.
Yeah.
Bartending, ski patroller.
Yeah, man. And then guiding. And he was an amazing brook trout fisherman, like flatwater guy. Right. So anyways, I was like, dude. Look, all in fly, and I'm in the fly fishing world and meeting all these great people and all these opportunities to like, hey, come visit. I'm like, let's start traveling. Let's go to all these places. We know all these people. And he felt like he won the lottery living where we lived, you know, which it's a beautiful place. So I finally convinced him to take a trip to Belize. Okay. very friendly with Lorianne Murphy, very good friend of mine. She lives down there. We're going to go hang out. We're going to DIY fish. He's like, okay, finally, we're going to do it. And we get down there and he's not doing well at all, like just not feeling well. But he's toughing it out. And we got home and the next day we went to the doctor. He actually had an appointment scheduled. We went to the doctor. She's like, yeah, I want to do like a lung x-ray. So we went to the ER for a lung x-ray and they took 4 liters of fluid out of his lung that day. And the doctor was like, I don't know how you survived like 3 flights yesterday. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning. So they didn't know exactly where the primary was, where it started. It probably started in his intestinal tract, but it ended up really manifesting in his lung. And that was the beginning of the end. And it was fast and it was bad, you know. And after that, I was like, you know, that's just... I'm sure you can relate, like after your brother went, like things changed dramatically, in your life and how you look at life, for sure. So,
but I also see I think you made this quote, go chase your hope, go chase your dreams, go live.
Yeah. Well, that's a classic
fully,
thing, right?
But I can't imagine you not having lived fully prior to his death.
Yeah,
because you look like such an effervescent person. You're always on fire.
Not really, but thank you for saying that. But yeah, but that's okay. Yeah.
And then after that, you really started traveling more.
Well, I, heavy grief is pretty brutal, right? I was in the Adirondacks and I was, just overwhelmed and didn't really understand what was happening to me. I'd never really been through any serious loss like that. And it was affecting me, obviously, mentally, physically, everything. And in a very small community, I wanted to go someplace where nobody knew me. I would go into places and people are weird with grief, man. Grief is a tough one, especially in this country, I think. People don't really know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. The people that are around you, And everybody, I think people think that they can fix it, And people will say the classic things like, well, he's in a better place. Or, when one door closes, another one opens, all these.
Yeah, fuck that.
Well, whatever. But people, because people are uncomfortable, right? About talking about it and how do you help people through grief, And really, I learned a lot, man. I mean, but at that time, I didn't really understand what was going on. So you could see it, you'd walk into a room and people would like leave, because they didn't want to deal with it.
No kidding.
Well, I mean, it was just.
They didn't know what to say.
They didn't know what to say. So I was like, dude, I got to get the fuck out of here. I just want to go someplace where nobody knows me. And nobody knows what happened to me, And I had had one trip, like a hosted trip to Argentina scheduled. And I said, I'm going to go early by myself. I'm going to go hang out by myself there and do some fishing.
Are these the people that you're here at the trade show with?
Yeah, the set guys. I had a hosted trip set up with them. But in the town of Junin, I did some... intel and found like, okay, there's good waiting opportunities there. And I have a friend in Bariloche, a nice kid that actually is a guide there. And Jeff and I worked in Alaska. We guided in Alaska for 10 years. We guided float trips. And this kid actually worked with us as like a boat guy. We taught him to fly fish and he's an amazing guide on the Lamai. So I knew I was going to visit him, but I had like 2 weeks by myself. And that time was awesome for me. I really kind of got my shit together and I was fishing my ass off on the Majeo River. It was unbelievable. I had this little, stayed in the most amazing little dive of a hotel. It was one of the first fishing lodges ever in Argentina. You walked into, it's called Osteria Chimuin. It's in Junin de los Andes. The whole thing is full of pictures of like Joe Brooks. Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, really?
Oh, dude, it was amazing. It was a dive, right? It was $50 a day with breakfast. It was amazing. But, I mean, it was a dive place to stay.
I want to be there right now.
Oh, it was pretty cool. And then it was maybe 45 minutes to the Majeo. And I had a little rent-a-car, and I fished that whole thing.
Did you is that when you healed?
I think it was very healing
in that
for me.
Period of,
it was.
2 weeks?
Yeah, I think you're always healing, you know, from grief. I don't think grief. I don't know. I don't know if it ever it gets better.
You know what?
It just
I
gets
found?
Different, right?
You know what I found?
Hold on 1 second. You did say that in the film, and I wrote this down. You said it doesn't get any easier when you lose someone with time. It just gets different.
Yeah,
I think so. What do you think about your brother with that?
I think that initially. It's right here.
Yes.
You can't get rid of it.
Yes.
You see it. You feel it.
Yes.
You smell it. The death of my mom, my dad.
Yes.
There's, you know, they're older.
Yes.
But all death, family members, loved ones.
Yes.
You cannot get it over here to the side.
Right.
And eventually, I know that they say time heals all things.
Yeah.
And it definitely does.
Yes.
It doesn't heal it.
Right.
But it makes you capable of dealing
yes.
with it.
And, yes.
and I eventually, it eventually for me, grief has the ability to move right over here.
Right on.
And you can tap into it whenever you want.
Right. Or it'll tap you.
Yeah. I mean, you have this always, this constant, you know, communication and relationship.
Yeah.
But what I really hate about big heartbreak is I cannot fucking get around the corner.
Right.
And I'm this I when I felt grief in my life, I would crawl up in a ball.
Yeah.
I crawled up in a ball and for 2 years one time.
Yep, I hear you, man. I totally every fucking
every night
hear
at
you.
5, I start drinking Jack Daniels.
Yep.
I'm
oh,
on
yeah.
Xanax 24/7.
Oh, yeah.
And finally, I just one day I woke up personally.
Yeah.
I woke up sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Right on, man.
And all of a sudden, I had a clear path.
Let me ask you this. Did you do a lot of fishing at that time?
I couldn't do anything.
You couldn't do anything.
One time I was tarpon fishing.
Yeah.
At 10 o'clock in the morning, I couldn't stop crying.
Yeah.
I said, I was with Eric Herstead.
Uh-huh.
I said, Eric, take me home. I just want
yeah.
to go home. And I do best in a dark corner.
Right.
Just no people, no
right.
sound, no sight, nothing.
I hear you there. I mean, right after Jeff passed, he passed in October, on October 2nd. And I did a lot of fishing. You know, I fish solo a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy fishing solo. I mean, this is trout fishing, you know, wading and stuff. So I don't need a boat. I don't need somebody else to pull me around or whatever. But I did a lot of fishing. In fact, there's the funeral home where I had him cremated. Jeff did not want a big funeral. He didn't want, you know,
mm-hmm.
he wanted a party, you know. We eventually had it 2 years later because of COVID, but whatever. But I dropped off his ashes, or I picked up his ashes at the funeral home, and then I went landlocked salmon fishing like around the corner. It was in downtown Plattsburgh, you know. And for me, like fishing was like, for me, fishing is always about a place where I can, like, my brain turns off. You know,
you and, just react,
and I don't have to think about anything
mm-hmm.
but fishing, for me at least, you know, and that was very important to me, like at that time or any time where I'm in serious. I mean, it's sort of like my denial place, you know, all I'm doing is focusing on fishing.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my mom in December, this past December. And, you know, she was old and she had Alzheimer's, and we knew, and she wasn't there really for a while, you know, and we knew we were going to lose her. And I didn't think that it would hit me as hard as it did. So like this whole past month, I've been kind of like you, and I don't have fishing right now. It's like, I've been into that dark place. So this is actually my first, and I live alone and I have a dog, you know, but there are days where I don't even talk to anybody. So that is brutal, right? And I was almost like, God, I wish it was fishing season, because then I could at least
do something,
be
right.
out there, like, engaging. But yeah, but you get, yeah, I agree with you. Like, it starts to, or I almost look at it sometimes like I'm just trying, like there's a huge weight on top of me and I can't lift it, you know, and maybe some days I can move it, you know. Mm-hmm. And there have been days in the last month where, man, if I like went out and chopped some wood and got the stove going, I mean, that's about all I did all day, you know, and you feel horrible about that, but it just paralyzes you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's horrible, and everybody goes through it.
Everybody.
You know,
yeah.
and then, yeah, maybe it does get lighter or whatever, but I don't know. I like to, you know, think that really, and this is true of a lot of things, like the only way through it is through it.
Yeah.
You know, nothing's going to.
Everybody has their own path through through pain.
For sure, man. And but I think this time with my mom, like I kind of had like I understood it better because of going through what I did with Jeff. I said, OK, I understand what's happening to me. But that didn't make it any easier, you know. So,
right.
So it is, you know, but it's but I think when you lose somebody and you see like, for instance, Jeff, he was 65 and he had just retired. And he loved to bird hunt. He was a bird hunting guide as well. And he had plans, you know, he wanted to travel and with the dogs and do this and that and this and that. And he never got to do any of it, you know.
Sad.
And it was sad. And so that, to me, gave me like the, okay, I'm going to fucking do it, you know. Like, I'm not going to wait, you know. And there are a lot of reasons why people do wait, you know, but a lot of reasons are those, a lot of those reasons I think are not good. You know, I mean, just the whole, it's a total stereotype, but like life is short, man, you know, like you don't know when something's going to happen or, and so, you know, if you can do it, you know, do it. And I've just started to sort of follow through on some of that stuff. And it's kind of a weird feeling, and I feel a little guilty about it sometimes because I know if, like, Jeff were alive, I might not be doing a lot of the stuff that I'm doing that I'm really enjoying, you know? I mean, that's part of a relationship, you know? I don't know if you're married or anything.
I am,
but,
yeah.
But, you know, you make, you know.
You know, I, you know, Rachel, compromises I think, too, you know, from afar across this table listening, there's almost kind of a freeing thing at some point. Where you have this burden, this black cloud, this weight, this, you know, it's here, it's here, it's everywhere. And once you can get around that corner, you can see life in such a better perspective. Like, wow. And especially when you start looking at age.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm 71. So let's just
I'm
say
61.
I take a ruler and I've got 100 inches for 100 years.
Yeah.
If you can get to 100, I'm 71. So now I'm looking, I'm closer to the end than I am to the middle.
Sure.
So now I've got maybe so many years that I'm going to be really capable of still doing a lot of great things.
Right.
But pretty soon I'm going to fall off that cliff. I've already started that downhill slide. But the freeing thing is like you were just talking about, man, life is short. Let's get after it.
Yeah.
You know, and all these great things about and dreams about traveling the world and fishing great places.
Yeah.
I'm starting to think, too, a little bit more so like you.
Yeah.
Like Nikki, let's go do these things.
Yeah.
Let's go to catch Dorado in Bolivia.
Yeah.
Or let's go catch striped marlin in Mags Bay. I'm going to do that because if you don't do it now, you won't do it.
Right. But go catch a Dorado in Argentina, too, man.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
pretty
for
fucking
sure.
Awesome. But that was amazing. And then I also, I'm a bit of a, I don't know. I believe in karma, you know? And
do you believe in God?
Do I believe in God? Technically, no. I believe in fishing, man. It's true. Like, when I'm fishing, I feel like that's my religion, you know? I mean, I grew up Jewish. I mean, I was bat mitzvah, the whole spiel, you know. I went to Hebrew school, Reformed Jew, but whatever. I don't, yes, if I write on a form, yes, I'm Jewish or whatever, but I'm not like a practicing Jew. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, I will go to a Seder or, you know, if whatever.
You're more spiritual than religious.
Yes, and I feel like fishing to me is very spiritual. You know, just the whole act of the whole process of it. Like, even if you're not technically always fishing all the time, but the places you go and the things that you see, you know, or wherever you are,
yeah,
whether you're
sure.
in Argentina or in, you know, even in New Jersey, you could be on a trout stream and still have, you know, places where you're going to start, you know, thinking about things bigger than you or seeing things that will sort of say, well, how did that fucking get here? You know, like, I don't know. You know, I like to look at little details when I'm on the water, like the way the foam, you know, or lichen and things like that and things that are very, you know, details and things like that.
Well, you're an artist. You're looking at every stroke.
Yeah, or it depends too, like where you are. Like when I was doing a lot, and that'll always inform my art as well. When I used to spend a lot of time windsurfing, I was always on the water. So I'm seeing like very big, you know, horizon, you know, large space, and trying to maybe let that inform my work. And then I moved to the mountains and in the woods a lot. And I became very aware that I was like, wow, I'm kind of surrounded a little more. Unless, you know, you climb and go up, you still have, you have both, you know. Mm-hmm. And I used to do, when I was in graduate school, you know, we would read a lot of theory and very complicated books and things like that. And it was very hard for me just to, you know, like French deconstructive theory and all of this really brainy shit. And I'm like, dude, what the fuck? I don't get it. And then finally, I stumbled upon this guy. His name is Gaston Bachelard. And it's a pretty famous book in art schools. It's called The Poetics of Space. He wrote many books. This guy was kind of a cool dude. He was a poet and a philosopher and a scientist. And he wrote a whole book about fire, you know, like what it's, because we all know when we look at fire, you kind of start dreaming into mm-hmm. it, you know, mm-hmm. and all
sure,
of the
sure.
connotations of that. But the book about space was really cool. To me, at least. And he wrote about this feeling that he had of intimate immensity, okay? So, like, that you could still feel, like, the bigness of things, even though you were...
Confined.
Mm-hmm. And I started, like, thinking about that, like, being in the woods or being in the water. You know, the trout streams where I am are very intimate. And I started really loving that and letting that inform my work. I'm a bit of an abstract painter, so using... things like that to inform what I was making or whatever. But
how many cigars do you smoke a day?
Way too many, man.
Let's see. I'm trying to figure out if my dad smokes more than you on the water.
There's
you
no
smoke.
Way that he does. No way.
I got a quick question.
How many
for
do you smoke a day?
Depends on how good the fishing is.
Right.
Like if we're tarpon fishing, it's good. We chain smoke cigars all day
long.
Yeah.
We'll do three, four.
Oh, yeah. That's...
Big fat, you know.
What's your favorite
Cuban
cigar?
Monte Cristo number two.
Oh, nice.
That's a good one.
That's a nice one. So I started off, good story, tons of black flies in the Adirondacks. Brutal. I don't know if you guys have them out west.
That's how I started too.
The worst MFs ever. The black flies bite
your
ass.
Horrible, right?
They take chunks off your body.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're just... So when I started fly fishing, Jeff was a cigarette smoker, and he used to roll his own cigarettes. He's also a huge pot smoker. But up to that point, I had never been a cigarette smoker. Smoked a bunch of pot, whatever. So we're out on the stream. Bugs are fucking brutal. And he's like, oh, you got to have some smoke, you know? So he bought me a pack of Swisher Sweets.
Jake Paul Dixon, too. Swisher Sweets, that's all he smoked.
So I'm like, okay. So I light one up. And like I said, up until that point, every only thing I had really smoked was pot, right? So what
so
do I do? I'm like, with a Swisher Sweet. Like, dude, that's like disaster, right? I immediately threw up all over the place, you know? And but like any good addict, I really adapted pretty quick and figured it out. And then I realized, just like, you know, when you start drinking as a kid, you drink like cheap shit, like Boone's Farm and... And those premixed, like, well, now there's premixed everything. But back then, like, what was, oh, do you have
Liefer Milch? Liefer Milch.
Okay. We had, like, this stuff called Tango, which was like a premixed screwdriver with basically like Tang and cheap vodka. And that's like the first thing I drank where you got super sick. Like, I'll never have another screwdriver again. Do you have a drink like that? Like, your first, like, that you got so fucking sick from?
Yeah.
Well, no, remember?
Unfortunately, I still continue to go down that ugly road once in a while. Jack Daniels okay. is, you know, I go, he and I go way back.
You were telling me a story about the first time you smoked a cigarette as a kid and your dad caught you.
Oh, yeah. My dad caught me smoking cigarettes. He made me smoke the whole fucking pack.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
That's brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
That's brilliant.
No, but get this. So my dad was a real redneck German man, right?
Uh-huh.
And he worked his ass off. He didn't have running water.
What did he do?
He was in the lumber business, but as a young man, he didn't have running water or a toilet in the house until he was 18 years old.
In Germany or
no,
in the States?
No, there's in the States. They were all farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And,
where?
in Wyoming.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was born in Laramie, Wyoming.
Uh-huh.
And he always told me, and he was kind of a real redneck, strict uh-huh. man. And then we moved to Aspen. And I was 7 years old when we got to Aspen, and eventually I started, you know, getting around. I mean, Aspen was on fire back in the early 70s
right.
and through the 80s.
Sure.
And at some point, all my buddies were smoking pot, but I was a skier,
yeah.
so I was
yeah.
never doing that
right.
stuff. But I broke my leg
uh-huh.
when I was about 16, so now I'm bored. I've got nothing to do. My buddies say, hey, let's go smoke some pot, right?
Yeah.
So I come home. Fucking stoned, man, and I'm like paranoid,
uh-huh.
so scared. My dad always told me, if I catch you smoking
oh,
pot,
no.
I'm calling the cops. So here I am, a little 16-year-old kid. My eyes are bloodshot. It looked like, oh my, I had fire in my eyeballs. That was the first sign, you know. My dad started saying, okay, you just tell me what you've been doing, and everything's going to be good. I just want to hear the story. You know, he set me up.
Yeah. Said,
well, Joey and I smoked some pot. God damn it! Are you fucking kidding me? Smoking pot? He called the cops.
No. No. Did they come?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I love it.
Sheriff Whitmire came to the front door. He's got six shooters on his hips.
And you're and shitting in your pants,
I'm
right?
shitting my pants. 16-year-old stoned-ass fucking young little kid. Oh.
And he scared the shit out of you.
Oh, no doubt. I can never smoke pot again.
And your dad probably talked to him on the phone. Like,
every
just,
time
just
I smoke
come over
pot.
And scare the shit out of him.
Yeah.
Oh,
every
I love
time
it.
I smoke pot after that, I could see Sheriff Whitmire coming.
Oh,
coming
yeah. That's
house.
Good, man.
Yeah, man.
That's good. So, yeah. So I fucking, I hurled on the water. But again, I adapted quickly. And, you know, we started guiding in Alaska, and that's a pretty buggy place. And I was smoking back then. I like Punch Rothschild Double Maduros. I like a dark cigar. Mm. But I started, you know, I mean, easily 5, 4, 5, 6 a day. No problem.
Yeah.
No problem.
Those are some good numbers. Those are high.
Well, it's nothing
well,
to be proud of.
Well, the Swisher Sweets not real big and fat.
Well, no,
right
Swisher Sweets, these were the Punch Rothschilds and started getting expensive,
so they're
dude.
They're bigger. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Those are the real
and,
ones.
So now I'm just a backwoods, addict, and I should be on an ambassador for them on their pro staff. but no, it's nothing to be proud of. It's a bad habit. In the beginning, you know, I don't know. It's just like anything, you know, you kind of, I have an addictive personality. So let's just say I'm a pretty good addict, which is nothing to be proud of again. So
mm-hmm.
I do.
Was there any worries after having cancer that you were smoking these things?
For a little while, yeah. I mean, again, it's not a good practice. It's kind of happened, I think, right after I got sick. I was very conscious of my health.
Mm-hmm.
And then, for me at least, I kind of went through, and I'm still in it, maybe coming out of it, into more of a denial of my health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't want to know what's wrong with me. You know, I feel fine, you know,
yeah.
but like more preventative things, like skipping that mammogram and skipping that, you know, check up, you know.
It's don't like, skip those things.
I know, but that I can tell you that, I kind of went through a period like that. Yeah, I shouldn't be smoking as a cancer survivor for sure. But again, I don't know. I need, got to have some vice, right?
I think yeah. that too, it's almost like, you know, this is part of your freedom after your cancer and the losing Jeff.
Yeah.
You just want to be free and go fishing.
I know, but it's bad. It's really bad.
Yeah,
and
no,
I, you know, I had a real, my dad's like a type 2 diabetic. I was like right on the cusp of that and heavy. And I went on I lost 50 pounds and I was like, doing all right for a little while. Then I'm sort of now on the back. I haven't gained 50 pounds back, but I definitely gained a little bit of that weight back and need to, as you know, at our age, you mm-hmm. know, it's not easy to
no.
keep it going, man. So mm-hmm. I, you know, yes, I do need to stop smoking. I need to work on it. Some of these guys are into those, the Zyn.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do that?
Mm-mm.
Do you know that it's like a chew, but it's a,
I
it's
have,
a
pack of I yeah, have yeah. done it, but yeah. yeah.
I might need to start doing that.
You know what? I want to go back to the fishing and
yeah.
going to
Let's
the river.
Let's talk fishing.
Do you find certain days you go to the river and your mood and your energy is not matching your surrounding, you know, water, river, and the hatches, and you're like, you have maybe a lot of too much energy. I'm going to force this.
Yes.
And it doesn't work.
Yes.
And other days you go to the river and you sit back and you're a little bit more mellow and calm.
Yes.
And you start feeling, the birds and the match or yep. the hatch and the flies in the river, and all of a sudden you get dialed before you ever even put a fly on, tie a fly on.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And those days are just like you jam.
Magic.
And
yeah.
other days the river's not available to receive you
yep.
in any way.
For sure.
Tell me about the balance and imbalance
okay.
of you as a guide, or maybe just you as a fisherman
well,
in the river
too. Well, it would be different.
Too.
Well, I'm very intuitive. Okay. And that I think comes from my artistic side. And I'm always at my best when I trust myself. Most people are, right? But as far as being an angler and a guide, I've had more success on the days where I accept, like, what I'm, you know, like, and it'll just happen, like, you're driving to a spot, and then all of a sudden I'll be like, no, go to this spot. And I'll be like, then your right brain will be like, no, don't go to that spot. That's too far and whatever. But just fucking listening, accepting like I hear voices or anything like that.
Relying on your instincts.
And your instinct, yeah. on your intuition. I've had more success doing that or making choices about what we're going to do here, you know, with a client per se. Like, okay, yeah, let's like instead of fishing a streamer, let's try a really big dry and maybe give it some action, you know, mm-hmm. like a little surface activity. Where I live, that's really key when you're fishing dries. We fish a lot of dry flies in pocket water. We're not seeing a lot of rising fish, but you can make them rise.
So you're right? bouncing them
yeah,
or you're
skittering
them. Yeah,
huge. Yeah. You know, but whatever. Just but whatever that choice is. But by being intuitive, I've had more success. Whatever that means, you know, as far as having a really good day, whether it's myself or with a client by sort of following that voice or whatever. But as far as, yeah, the attitude of fishing, I might have it in my, if I'm fishing by myself, I say, okay, I'm going to go from point A to point, not B, C, up all the way to F. I'm going to wade this whole thing and then I'll walk back to my car and it's, you know, and just walk up the middle of the river the whole way and fish it. You know,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, some days you're like, oh, dude, this is amazing. I'm crushing it, you know, catching fish and just feeling really solid. And then other days you're like, oh, I don't have it in me today, man. I don't have. So I'm going to like go back maybe. And but that doesn't mean you're out of the game. You know, maybe I'm going to slow down a little bit, you know, and I really love to swing flies. Absolutely love, two-handed casting. I'm not very good at it, but I really enjoy it. And I've had some amazing clients over the years, older guys that have taught me so much about swinging wets. Do you guys ever swing wets for trout or?
I mean, I nymph fish with the bottom wet fly and then I'll, you know, swing it at the end. And
you're
a lot of times.
Dirty ass nympher?
Yeah.
Okay. I am too. But no, I'm talking like traditional.
No, no.
Dragging jewelry down the ditch.
Traditional, like, you know, one or two or even what they call a brace of flies, two or three.
No,
that was
never done that.
But I had some amazing, the old guys are the fucking best, right? I had a guy, he was a doctor. I mean, when I got him, he was probably in his 80s. And, you know, he didn't need a guide. He needed somebody to help him. You know, he would, you know, could barely tie a fly on. I would tie a fly on and I'd show it to him. He'd go, oh, you know, he was so stoked. And he would just, you know, and then he would stop. Or he would let out all this, like, I'm like, what is this guy doing? I'm just going to watch. Shut up, Rachel. Shut up. Don't get, because I'm a bit of a, I can be a little bossy sometimes. So it's hard to tell. But whatever. And just learn. And this guy would just, like, lift his rod. I had another guy like that that would actually light his pipe during that time, right? He would throw a streamer out. Mend, mend, mend. Slack, slack, slack. Take his pipe out, and he would fucking pick it up, and there'd be a fish on it almost every fucking time. But swinging wets is just sort of, I don't know, I love the idea of, it's so subtle, and you have to sort of imagine being that fly, like a good nympher would. I mean, are you a indicator guy or dry dropper or Euro?
Dry dropper, indicator. I don't Euro fish.
Okay.
But a lot of times when that, you know, in the dead heat of summer, the Euro is how to get them.
Dude, it's...
Yeah, it's how to get them. So...
It's pretty amazing.
I'm going to start doing that. What's worse, why
is that worse than, like, watching an indicator? I think it's actually more fun with Euro. I mean, there are problems with Euro. There's no question in my mind.
You know why? I like watching the indicator move.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I get that. I mean, but I think like tight line or whatever, I like to call Euro nymphing contact nymphing, okay?
Yeah, and a lot of times I can't get right up to the hole.
Right.
So I'm fishing a hole that's 12 feet across.
Okay, well, there is a time and a place for the indicator.
It's a little tough
for sure.
With the Euro there.
But for pocket water fishing in relatively shallow water, I'd say 4 feet and lower,
yep,
there is nothing more effective than contact or tight line.
Sure.
Because you have so much control over that fly.
Right.
But the whole idea, too, is you have to, like, know where that fly is. But you have – so when you're – when I explain this to people and I say, okay, we're going to fish – when you fish an indicator, like, do you know where your fly is? Kind of, but no.
You never.
When you tightline fish, you know exactly where your fly is, dude. And when you're, like, for instance, on my river, you'll have, like, you'll see a pocket – like maybe with a little plunge, you know there's a fucking fish there, right? But to actually get a fly to that depth that quickly with an indicator is tough.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So the tight line or the whatever you want to call it is very effective. I think that for me, I'm more engaged. It's very visual. But, you know, watching an indicator is also visual. I think that the danger of that type of Euro style is that people are just catching a lot of fucking fish and they're putting a lot of they're damaging a lot. Right. I mean, there's a lot. It's amazing how many more fish you're going to catch that way. Is that always the goal? Maybe not, you know, and I think that it's detrimental to the fish for sure.
As we get closer to the end of this podcast, if someone wants to fish with you, Rachel, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Okay. I work at a place called the Hungry Trout. It's in Wilmington, New York. You can look it up online, hungrytrout.com, hungrytroutflyshop.com, I think it is. And then I do some trips to Argentina with the guys from Set Fly Fishing. But you can reach me through the Hungry Trout for that as well.
Awesome. And then what rivers do you fish?
I fish the West Branch of the Aussable, and then also the Saranac River system. These are all in northern New York. And then I fish all the way up to the Canadian border. There's some excellent fishing up in the watershed that flows into the St. Lawrence River. The watershed that I'm in flows into Lake Champlain, the Salmon River. It's not the Salmon River with the steelhead in it that people know in New York, and the Chateauguay River and a bunch of ponds and stuff like that. We do some smallmouth fishing as well,
which is
also just becoming a reality because of climate. We're in the crosshairs of climate. Problems where I live. We're having real problems with water temps and having water way too warm to be fishing in.
Is this like a 8-9 month fishery or?
It's May to October.
Okay.
You know?
Best time, your favorite time to fish?
Anytime you can, man.
If someone wanted to fish with you.
All right. Okay. I'd say I like the fall, September. You know, I would say like June, but now June is almost too warm. I'd say May. May is good.
Cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Anything else that you would like to add to this great conversation?
Well, I wish we could have talked more about fishing, but I think we had a good conversation. I would just say, you know, like we have so much knowledge right now, you know, and there's so much available knowledge to us, and I think people need to slow down a little bit, you know, and not worry so much about how many fish they're catching or how big they are, and really enjoy like the I have a very good friend who's a very good guide. His name is Jason Dapra. He guides on the Delaware. He's also a great saltwater guy. He does the fall run on Montauk, and he guides for some really big stripers in Jersey. And he has, I stole this completely from him. He'll say, it's all about the hang. You know, fishing is all about the hang, which I wholeheartedly agree with. It's all about, mm-hmm. you know, being with your buddies or whatever. It's all about the trip there where you like tripped over the whatever pavement and broke your shoulder or whatever. It's not about that. But I mean, it's about the process.
Sure.
And that's what art is about, too. For me, it's about the process. It is about the end result for sure. And I just think that for me, at least, getting involved with fishing, which was the last thing I ever thought I would be involved with, has been one of the best gifts of all, you know, and it's all about the people that I've met, you know, and the, mm-hmm. and the great community that we have. I mean, wouldn't you agree?
Amen. Yeah. I totally agree.
That's what Popovich was preaching, you know, a couple of days ago during his podcast. He said, man, it's not about the fish. It's all my buddies. Look at them. They're all the photographs of all of his right. friends are in his room.
Right.
These are my pals.
Right. This that being said, though, I think we also, especially now, that we have a responsibility to, like, take care of the resource.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Especially now with so, you know, a lot of shit happening in the world, and we need to make time for you to be, you know, more of an activist and to get involved with conservation, mm-hmm. whatever kind of resource you're working with, whether it's ocean, rivers, et cetera, et cetera. So that I haven't been the best at through my time. I think I've been a little selfish and share that and share some of my time towards that kind of
well,
stuff.
Well, you have time left, you know.
Oh, I dude, mean, yeah, man.
There's a certain point where all of a sudden, you know, for me, it's like it's okay to be fishing less, but raising money more.
Yeah.
Traveling more to raise money.
Yep.
Not necessarily making money for me, but making right. money, raising money for BTT, for Captains for Clean Water,
absolutely.
IGFA, all those organizations. And, you know, I've always thought, in the old adage, you know, think globally, but act locally.
Right.
Take care of your house.
Exactly.
And that's a start. And if everybody took care of their local waters,
right.
That will really solve a lot of problems.
Right. And that can be a little intimidating, too, to, you know, where do I start? You know, how do I help? You know, I don't have a lot of money. You know, what can I do? Yeah, you have time.
Go help raise money.
And make small changes in your own life, you know? Like,
sure. You know, one of the things I do, Rachel, I don't like catching fish anymore in my home water.
Okay.
I really don't.
Okay.
I go down during a hatch and like a caddis hatch, I'll throw it out there and watch the bite. I don't set the hook.
Uh-huh.
I don't need another trout in my hand. And I'll just spend the evening smoking a cigar.
Yeah.
Boom. There's one. Boom.
Yeah.
And when I float a river, I feel badly that when I hook a fish, it takes 200 yards to release him because
yeah.
you're floating.
Yeah.
And now the fish are going, wow, man, where's my house?
Yeah.
You know, what happened to me? So that's the way I'm starting to think. And when I get on the boat with Jay Scott,
yeah.
we'll float from Aspen to Basalt. And I said, Jay, I really don't want to catch a fish today. He goes, what do you mean? I said, well, this is hang.
Yeah.
Get like 100 bites and catch
yeah.
maybe two accidentally.
Dude, you should just cut the hook off.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay because if you don't do anything, there's a good chance you're not going to catch them anyway.
I had, Joan Wolf years ago, you know, she's amazing, right? So many, many years ago, she came up to the Adirondacks. They were making a film about Lee and they were using some of our private water from the Hungry Trout. So I took them out. I wasn't guiding them. And she showed me a great trick, like, because I'll do this for guiding. I'll go out and scout, but you don't want to catch those fish. Mm-hmm. She's like, cut the hook off of a fly and just, you know.
At the bend?
Yeah. And also, like, if you're demoing for a client,
right.
what's the worst thing that could possibly happen?
Yeah, you're going to catch one.
You're
right
going to catch
away.
One. And where I am, that could be, like, the only fish of the day, dude.
Oh,
that's not
God.
A good thing. So I started doing that. And
yeah, that's
yeah.
good.
Yeah, and there are people that will fish that way. I mean, she's amazing and... quick story, though, when we were out on the water with them, again, I wasn't guiding, and she looks over to me, and she says, hey, can you tie a tippet on for me? And I don't even know if I had my guide's license yet. So I'm like, okay.
How old is she at the time?
Oh, she was probably in her 60s. Like, she's still, I mean, I've been lucky enough to spend some time with her in the last couple of years. She's still doing pretty good, man. I think she's 95 or 96. She's amazing. But she was probably in her early 60s, asked me to tie a tippet on. And again, I didn't know anything. So I...
It's like polishing Stu Apps real.
So I asked her, I said, well, how much, right? So, I mean, I'm taller than her. And I don't even think she was wearing glasses, but she basically was like, you don't fucking know. You know, I mean, she didn't say that, you know, but she like looks at me like, and she's like, tells me how much. I'm like, okay. So I cut it off and then I start tying a surgeon's knot. Double surgeon's knot. And she looks at me and she says, oh, you use the easy knot. You know, like you're not tying a blood knot, right? And I just about shit in my pants, you know? And from that day on, I still will tie. But she's a hard ass. But what an amazing, she's a hero of mine for sure, man. You should interview her.
You know, I'd been talking to her. We were supposed to interview her on Wednesday of this week.
Uh-huh.
So about a month ago, I called her, you know, and we had a great conversation. And she said, oh, you know, I don't remember much. I said, well, neither do I.
Yeah.
We'll have a great time. So I got her all chummed up, and she was going to do it. And then she canceled like last week just before we got here.
Oh, that's too bad.
It was just such a bummer because she's been such a great inspiration for so many people.
Oh, men and women. She's just amazing.
Absolutely.
She's a badass, let me tell you. I mean, just incredible. And to think about what she had to go through, you know, is really pretty amazing. And
she's one of the unicorns.
I bought her DVD and both her books. And I watched everything. I read the book, and I've got all these notes. I got, you know, 6 pages of notes on Joan. I'm all keyed up, ready for this interview. And then she says, "Yeah, I didn't."
I get it, man. You know,
I say, Joan, it's all good, man. I want you to be happy.
She's amazing, and I just hope that, like a lot of the young people coming into fishing, men and women, will know who she is. And I mean, she's got her place in history for sure. But, you know, that we celebrate her as much as we can, you know, because she's just amazing.
Yeah, no doubt.
We got to wrap this up. But okay. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you guys,
really,
man. I could chat it up with you for a while, but let's go do some work.
That's all.
You got a great life in that film that Fly Lords and Costa and American Museum of Fly Fishing did. If you haven't seen it, it's called After You're Gone.
After You've Gone.
After You've Gone. It's incredible.
Yeah, so the Fly Lords, I had nothing to do with it, man. They're a really talented group of young guys, and I'm very proud of them that they were made a movie about fishing, but also about life. And for guys that young, you know, they're all in their late 20s, you know, to carry that off pretty well, they did a great job. So,
well, Rachel,
thanks.
You're a real inspiration and a hero to a lot of people.
I don't know about that, but...
No, let me tell you something. You are.
Okay.
I saw your movie and I called you. I said, dude, you're the fucking bomb. I love you. I love you. And I think a lot of our people or our audience are going to, you know, love you just
as much. Well, I hope so. I mean, it's all... I'm just one of many. There's so many of us out there. And thanks for having me.
Thanks, Rachel.
All right, man.
Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to see more content or behind the scenes, please follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We'll see you soon.